This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. How's your social battery doing right now? I've never used that phrase, but I instantly know what it means. And I think it's interesting because it works two different ways. Some people need to have their social battery charged, and they this is the introvert extrovert thing. And some people, you know, like they've got enough energy for other people, but then it's time to sort of step away. And, you know, as we get to this part where winter is ending, which again, it's opposite. I love winter. I don't need it to end. You know, you start getting together with more people and it can be a little draining on top of every other thing that we all have going on in our lives. I just assume everybody's overburdened because I think everybody's overburdened, but it can be tough to deal with. And also one of the things is like, you can't necessarily understand why you feel that way or why it's making you tired, but it's a real thing. If you think that you could use some help with it, if you could figure out a way to make things better, therapy is a great way to help. It can give you that kind of self-awareness to know how to ride that level just right so that you feel good, you feel right. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you can give BetterHelp a try. It is entirely online. It is designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule, which is, again, we've been talking about being busy, right? You got to fit that in. You got a lunch period. You can do it during that time, whichever. That's possible. You fill out a brief questionnaire and get matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. I like that. There is no penalty for finding the person who is right for you. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/iFanboy today. Get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/iFanboy.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This is iFanboy Special Edition Ant-Man and the Wasp. Welcome to iFanboy Special Edition Ant-Man and the Wasp. My name is Connor Kilpatrick, and I'm here, joined this week, by our special guest, Ron Richards.
Hey, Connor. It's good to be back.
Ron's former iFanboy co-host. He left us to go work at Marvel Entertainment. Disclaimer,
I do work for Marvel Entertainment. I work in Marvel New Media. Any opinion I give on this podcast is my own and not representative of Marvel or the Walt Disney Company. And to anybody who will question it, I am so far removed from the movie production. It's not even funny. So it's not like I have any influence or impact on studios or anything like that.
It might as well be a different company.
Yeah, exactly. It's great though. I love it. I was very excited to see this movie because I am a big Paul Rudd fan and I love the first movie and I wanted to see where they took it. But Connor, well, before I ask you what you thought of the movie, let's do the little setup. Who directed it, blah, 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 all that stuff.
So this is directed by Peyton Reed, who directed the first film, the first Ant-Man film. And it was written by five people, one of whom was Paul Rudd. Stars Paul Rudd as Scott Lang, Evangeline Lilly as Hope Van Dyne, the Wasp. And then you've got returning people like Michael Pena as his buddy Lewis and Michael Douglas as Hank Pym. Also returning, much to my delight, Bobby Cannavale in the small role as the best stepdad ever.
I'm so glad Bobby Cannavale, A, did not get forgotten, and B, it is in a much less adversarial role in this film.
So what I thought is that this was the perfect movie to come after Infinity War.
Yeah.
You had the heaviest films, the biggest stakes, you know, the long, epic, universe-shattering battle for almost 3 hours, and then you followed it up with a short, tight, again, a little heist movie. That's part comedy, part action film that takes place very much on the ground where the stakes are relatively low. Although I guess if you're talking about micro versus, but still relatively low stakes, it's a great counterpoint and reminder of how much width and breadth there is in the Marvel Universe, cinematic universe anyway.
Yeah. I mean, it's a nice little breath of fresh air after the heavy dose of Avengers Infinity War that happened, you know, kind of reminds you that in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, these kind of stories can happen while also big Thanos story is happening. And, you know, you'll get to it later on in the podcast, but the end credit sequence, of course, then answers everyone's question is where does this place in the timeline?
Right.
I believe the stock answer in the press junkets was concurrent with the Infinity War. But yeah, no, I love the fact that the main movie didn't, other than recounting the events of Civil War,
right,
exist on its own.
Yeah, and you know, at the end of Civil War, Scott Lang was in prison. Was it the raft or whatever it was?
In the water.
The floating prison with the rest of the Cap buddies, and then suddenly he's out, so we get that out of the way. He was under house arrest for 2 years, and now he's days away from getting out from under house arrest, so he has that going on. He's also estranged from Hope and Hank, who are on the run from the cops because it was their Ant-Man technology that was used in the Civil War. So he's all on his own. He is by himself. He gets to see his daughter on the weekends, but he's stuck in the house. He has him and his buddy Lewis and Dave and Kurt, the ex-cons, have started a business. Was it ex-con?
Ex-con, yeah. X-CON, yeah.
they do security consulting, and he can't even go into the office for that. So he's really stuck with his aunt buddies in the house.
But you got the sense that he wanted to focus on family. Like, family is such a huge theme of this whole movie.
Sure.
But also, you know, because the nature of his agreement or his settlement to the house arrest was that he can't have any contact with Hank Pym or Janet Van Dyne. Hope Van Dyne, sorry. Janet Van Dyne's her mother, right? Sorry. Hope Van Dyne. So he's really got to close the door on the Ant-Man part of his life. And what's funny is that you 2 years have passed, yet the movie opens and he's playing with his daughter in the confines of his house where they've created a ant-sized maze out of cardboard. So clearly while he's, you know, accepted that he's got to do his time for his daughter to get his life back on track and he's shut the door on being Ant-Man, it's still there.
For sure. Right? I mean, how can it not? You're a superhero. And then all of a sudden you're not, and your daughter adores that you're a superhero. But in the meantime, while he's playing with his daughter, he's also having visions of someone down in the microverse. What was it called?
Quantum Realm.
The Quantum Realm, where he went in the first film. He went super tiny into the Quantum Realm, which is where also, in the past, Janet Van Dyne disappeared to. And so he's now finding that he is entangled with her brain, and that leads him to reconnect with Hope and Hank. And in addition to trying to figure out a way to rescue Janet in the Quantum Realm, they also are being stalked by a ghost character who is intangible, as well as a bunch of low-life arms dealer types. Sonny Birch, who is a comic character played by Walton Goggins. So they have multiple things going on. While he's also evading the cops because he's not supposed to leave his house, but he does on multiple occasions to have his adventures. So there's a lot going on. I thought it was a big improvement over the first film. I liked the first film, but didn't love it. I thought it was good, but ultimately kind of middle of the road. But I thought this was an improvement over the first one.
Did you give the spoiler warning?
Spoiler warning.
Spoiler warning. I guess.
Yeah,
No, I agree. I think what's great, I mean, the fact that they, you know, Peyton Reed directed the first one and directed this one. But, you know, I don't know if the writing staff was this. The writers were the same in the first movie, the second movie. I know Paul Rudd has a writing credit in both movies.
Right.
I don't know about the other guys. But it just feels like a consistent, like, this is the next chapter. And it built on what they set up in the first Ant-Man. And they revisited stuff like when Carlos Peña does his, you know, fast-talking recap type thing. Like, they revisited that, but not in a way that's, like, eye-rolly or, like, okay, we get the joke.
I was concerned, but I was like, okay, when's that going to happen again? I'm just looking at the writers, and they are all different except for Paul Rudd.
Interesting. Yeah.
You knew that was coming. You knew that the patented Lewis storytelling was coming. It came multiple times in the first film, but they only use it once here, and I thought they used it to great effect.
Right, and they used it while he was under the influence of Truth Serum.
Which was fun. That was a great sequence.
Added to it as well, too, yeah. It was.
You know, they settled in comfortably to this world, these characters. Ant-Man is a much lower stakes hero. Paul Rudd's character, Scott, is kind of dumb, but he's a hero. He's a good guy. He plays off well with Hope and Hank, who are extremely smart and capable, and Hope is in many ways a much better hero than he is. And we should also point out that this is Marvel's first film with a female lead in the title and in the story.
Yep. And I thought she and Evangeline Lilly's great.
She's
terrific. She was great in the first one, but she's even better in this one. I mean, like, it was and what I liked about it was what I thought about the movie was that you had the through line, which is the A plot is, you know, that they're trying to get Janet Van Dyne out of the Quantum Realm. Like, that's the main one, right? But then you had several B, C, D plots happening.
Which were all weaving together.
Yeah, really nicely. You know, like, I thought, you know, so it wasn't too distracting, and one didn't overwhelm the other or take away from the other. They all wove in and affected each other in a natural kind of way. It's funny because there's no real villain in this movie. Like,
no, I thought that was a plus. I mean, the villain would be Sonny Birch, the Walton Goggins character. And Ghost, who you see a lot in the trailers, who's wearing all white, and she can phase, and she's a, you know, badass. She's ostensibly a villain, but what was great about the film was she was tragic. She was just trying to save herself. Her molecules were coming apart, and she was going to die. So it wasn't like, you know, stop her from destroying the world. It was, she was just trying to get the technology for herself to save her own life. And once they realized that, they start to try to help her. And that's what I thought was really great about it. I thought it was a much more sophisticated story than the first one. In which, you know, the first one had really great... I thought Yellowjacket was a terrific villain, but he was, you know, a mustache-twirling standard villain, where this was much more layered.
I really liked him. I forget the actor's name. He was on Girls. I really like Yellowjacket as a villain.
No, for sure.
We rewatched Ant-Man a couple of weeks ago, and I was like, oh, wow, he very mustache-twirling, but I liked it because I thought it worked, and he was enough of a foil, you know, to give a sense of danger. But I think that this movie benefited from not having that singular mustache-twirling villain.
Yeah, and the ones who were like that, which was, again, the arms dealers, were kind of not incompetent, but they were never really a threat. They were more comedic.
Meddlesome, you know. So the reference to the first Ant-Man movie requires... So there was a moment in the first Ant-Man movie when he is fighting Yellowjacket. Do you remember? And
also
they're on the helicopter, and they both shrink down, and they're inside... Cross, his name Darren Cross. No, was it Darren Cross? Or I don't know what the character's name, but Cross, you know, Yellowjacket's briefcase. And Yellowjacket yells at Ant-Man, I'm going to disintegrate you. And that triggers his cell phone, which is in the briefcase, and says, playing Disintegration by The Cure. Yeah. And we had this beautiful moment of these two tiny bug-sized guys fighting in a briefcase to The Cure's Disintegration, which was just awesome, right? So, but that laid the groundwork for the fact that, like, okay, Peyton Reed and the other people working the movie are of a certain type of people musically, right?
This is partially why I wanted you to be on the show.
Yeah, yeah. This is the main reason why we're breaking the Ron Can't Talk About Marvel stuff, because there's a moment, I tweeted about this, there's a moment in this movie where I completely screamed, where I don't even know how it got in and got into the final movie, but during Carlos Peña's Truth Serum infected babbling, he starts talking about his, well, because what happens is that he does this whole story about how he met Scott, and Walton Goggins is like, you know, get to the point. And the other guys, the other ex-cons, T.I. and the other guy, the guy doing the Russian accent, who's on Gotham, right? That guy was on Gotham.
Yeah, well, he's terrific.
He was great. I want to get back to him in a second. Yeah. But they say he's like a human jukebox. Once you put in the dime, you gotta listen to the whole song. And that triggers Luis to start talking about his grandmother's jukebox that only plays Morrissey songs. And they do these quick cuts of the jukebox, and I looked. It was all correct Morrissey songs. Like, it was all accurate. They played First of the Gang to Die during that moment, but then throughout the rest of the movie, every time Luis called Scott on his cell phone, the ringtone was Every Day is Like Sunday, which is like... And now that why this is funny is because, for those who don't know, two things. I'm a huge Morrissey fan, and a longtime My Fanboy listener knows this. But two is that Morrissey has a huge fan following amongst the Latino community, specifically L.A. and Mexico and all that sort of stuff. So that whole bit is 100% rooted in reality.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, and it was just like such a out of nowhere and specific, and like literally I was the only person in the theater laughing at it. Right? Maybe there were one or two other people laughing, but it was amazing. So that now, hands down, when we do our ranking of the 20 MCU movies, yes, Ant-Man and the Wasp is my number one because of this joke.
That little team of ex-cons, they had less to do this time, but when they were on, I thought they hit harder with their jokes.
Yeah.
To me, one of the funniest jokes was, so when the ghost shows up, they're all freaked out.
Yes.
Kurt, who is the Russian one, has some sort of Russian fairy tale or, you know.
Baba Yaga.
Baba Yaga. And when she shows up, he just starts singing the song to himself. I thought that was, to me, was the best joke in the whole movie.
That was very good. So that Kurt is played by David Desmalchian.
Right.
And yeah, and he does this whole great where early on in the show, they set it up.
Yes.
They set it up like 45 minutes earlier when it happened, because they're talking about ghosts and she's someone who can walk through walls. And he's like, oh, like Baba Yaga. And he tells them the story of Baba Yaga. And then at that moment, and then when Ghost comes in and appears, he starts singing the Baba Yaga song. It was very good. It was very, very good.
It was great. And as you said, this is a lot of family themes here. And I thought the search for Janet was really, I thought it was really suspenseful and sad, even though you knew they were going to find her. It was still, you could feel Hank's yearning for his wife and Hope's need for her mother. And when they finally found her, it was awesome. And
the tension in going into the quantum realm and the danger of that. And also I think they juxtaposed the dive into the quantum realm with the danger of the outside world, because basically this is all happening. Hank Pym's lab is able to shrink down to the size of like a toy set.
Yep.
Right. And everybody wants the lab for different reasons. You know, Walton Goggins wants it for the technology inside to sell in arms dealers. And then Ghost wants it to get to, because she believes it's going to, with the help of Bill Foster, which we'll get to in a second, will help her, fix her intangibility issue. And so the lab becomes like a hot potato. And meanwhile, Michael Douglas is in the quantum realm and he can't come back until the lab is full size. Like they added tension on top of tension on top of tension.
I thought it was much more sophisticated storytelling wise this time than the last time. It was funny that Marvel really loves its de-aging technology, which I have to admit is works pretty well. So in the flashbacks, we see young Michelle Pfeiffer and we see young Lawrence Fishburne. We see young Michael Douglas. But I will say this. Michelle Pfeiffer doesn't really need all that much de-aging technology. Whatever genetic lottery she's won it pretty well.
Right.
She still looks terrific.
Yeah.
So when she comes back, you just like, wow, she really, if she'd been 30 years younger, I know she was Catwoman, but she would have been a great superhero in this new age of superheroes. But we have Bill Foster, played by Lawrence Fishburne, who turns out to be a really important character to the story. I thought he was just going to be like a quick cameo type throwaway, joke from the trailer. But when he pops up in the middle as someone who's not a bad guy, but not necessarily on the side of the heroes of the audience, I was with gasps.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great reveal where he is actually trying to help Ghost survive.
It was a good twist, and not in a way of, he's the villain.
Yeah.
It's just, he's trying to help her and now they're at odds. But I really found myself wanting to know more about Bill Foster and Lawrence Fishburne's character, because he seemed way more admirable, not way more admirable than anybody else, but like he was trying to do the right thing by a ghost, right? Yep. Because she had you find out that her father was experimenting with something and she was the byproduct of it. And then S.H.I.E.L.D. worked with her and turned her into a weapon and all this other stuff. And you really build up this, she's had a rough go of it and he's just trying to make it right. I thought he was great. And it's funny because there were also what makes a great Marvel movie. And I know I'm biased because I worked there, but I said this before I worked there, is that there are little bits of stuff to tie us fans into it.
Mm-hmm.
So we meet Bill Foster, we find out that he worked with Hank Pym in the past on the Goliath project, right? And the comic fans are like, ooh, Goliath, or the fact that the FBI agent who's watching over Scott is Jimmy Woo.
Right.
Right, who's used in S.H.I.E.L.D. and in Agents of Atlas. And that sort of stuff. So, like, there are these loose threads back to the comics that we love, but in this world of the MCU, it hit it on the right notes. We're like, anybody could watch that movie and not care who Jimmy Woo is, but as a comic fan, you know who that guy is, and that's awesome.
Randall Park, who played Jimmy Woo, I thought was great. I loved his relationship.
He was great.
With Scott Lang up until the very end when they finally release him from house arrest, and they have that great exchange.
Yes.
See you later. Are we hanging out? Or
you asked me to dinner. Or?
do you want to go to dinner? Like it was a great weird keeper and prisoner relationship, and I hope we see him again if we get more Ant-Man, which looks like based on this weekend's numbers, we probably will. There was just a lot of great characters. It was a really pretty diverse cast, which was nice to see.
Yep.
A lot of different kind of actors getting a lot of different kind of roles. Great use of San Francisco, especially in the car chase, which I thought was a great sequence.
I will say, as somebody who lived in San Francisco, they really shot there, because there was one point where I loved what they did with the cars and the big, small, and doing all that sort of stuff. Like, that was great. But the car chase through San Francisco was fantastic. But there's one point where a car flips over or whatever, lands right in the middle of the intersection. No, actually, I think it might be the truck that when Scott is big that he's using as a scooter.
Yeah. Right?
But that was right in front of a bar called The Summer Place, which used to have pinball machines, and I've hung out there. Like I was like, I know exactly where that is. Like, that's really, like I love it when they really shoot in a location. Like, it's, yeah, it's a combination of really shooting in a location and doing physical, you know, like not CG effects, you know, which of course this is full of CG and all stuff like that. But having the tangibility of the cars and the things breaking around it, it felt practical. You know what I mean? Like, it was, yeah, CG, but felt practical, if that makes
and
sense.
Also, utilizing the terrain. So San Francisco is very hilly, especially in that part of town, and using that to their advantage in the car chase so that the size changing of the cars really affected how the cars drove on the hills. And yep, that, what's the super windy road that's in every movie?
Lombard Street.
So that was a great use of Lombard Street, where when they went tiny, they could navigate at high speeds where the big cars couldn't. And it was very smartly done in that sense. And I just think Evangeline Lilly, I'm surprised it's taken her this long to get like a really meaty movie role, because she's terrific on screen.
Yep.
She and Paul Rudd together are really great. It was just really fun. I think that's what the takeaway was it wasn't like laugh out loud funny all the time. It was funny all the way through, but it was also really fun just to hang out with these characters.
Yeah. And there were there was a handful of laugh out loud moments, but there was also for me at least, there was a steady stream of just sitting with a smile on my
yes,
face.
I think that was more it. And it sort of built. I remember in the beginning thinking, oh, all of these jokes aren't really landing. But it sort of got into the groove pretty quickly. And you're right, I think it was more like watching with a smile on your face than really like, you know, Deadpool laughing out loud kind of situation. It's not that kind of comedy.
Yeah, so many laughs that you miss jokes and things like that.
I'm trying
to
think of anything that I would change, and I can't really come up with anything.
Wow.
It does its job very well.
Yeah.
The characters are all fun. The stuff with the daughter is great. She was great. Just enough Judy Greer and Bobby Cannavale. I can't think of anything that I would change from it. I think it did a really good job.
It was really focused. It was very focused, and it was very much, again, like I said earlier, it was the next movie. It's the second movie in Ant, you know. And so I like that it stayed focused on that and didn't get too distracted by what you could do in this world, you know.
So now the real question is, so the mid-credit sequence.
Yeah.
So the movie ends, they rescue Janet, she comes back, she's got some quantum-verse powers that they haven't explored yet. I guess between the end of the movie and the mid-credit sequence, she's helped them miniaturize, which is, I guess, pretty obvious, miniaturize their gate that they used to get to the quantum-verse. It's no longer in the building, it now fits in the back of a van.
The tunnel.
They're going to send Scott down there to capture some more energy. They're going to use to help Ghost with her medical problems. And they send Scott down. He captures the energy. They're doing the countdown to bring him back up. And suddenly it stops on 3. We cut back to outside where we see everyone is floating dust. Just because now Thanos has, you know, instituted his purge. And now Scott is stuck in the quantumverse. No one to bring him back. I mean, I figured that was coming. And I figured it would be sad, which it was. But it's interesting they're sort of taking Scott off the board for Infinity War.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this is where I would just say, you know, it's going to be very exciting to see Captain Marvel come out, and then it'll be very exciting to see what's next for the Avengers. And then we'll just leave it at that.
But I just think it was an interesting choice to sort of strand him, make this, you know, in a place that's already dangerous enough.
I mean, I'll be honest with you, I know I'm you know, teasing by not saying anything. I don't know. I honestly do not know what's going to happen. I don't know what they're doing with it. I don't know. But I do know that these sequences are, as we've seen for 20 movies, are there for a reason.
Sure.
Right? And so, so I got to imagine that there's going to be an element revisited somewhere, whether it's in Captain Marvel or in the next Avengers. Like, I don't, you know, like I can't imagine they're just going to strand Scott in the quantum realm. Like, I gotta imagine that something will come of that.
I was surprised. I thought maybe we were in for like a switcheroo where Hope and Hank would disappear in front of Janet, you know what I mean? Like, they just finally got reunited and brought her back, and then they go away. But to send them all three away was an interesting choice.
Yeah. I mean, especially after establishing Hope as Wasp and like getting all excitement around that, now she's gone similar to Black Panther, you know,
right.
Like, you know, I still can't believe Black Panther is gone or Spider-Man or whatever, but we all know it's comics and we'll see what happens with it. And so, yeah, what I liked about the end credit sequence is, though, you have the mid credit sequence, which was the meat that everyone wanted. And then if you stay to the end credit sequence, there's a little stinger punchline where while Scott is, you know, out adventuring to protect him from breaking house arrest, they put an ant in his place to wear the bracelet and go through his daily routine. And one of the things he would do is play his little, you know, electronic drum set. And so the end credit sequence is that ant playing the drums. But what I thought was interesting was that we cut to Scott's house and the TV is showing a test pattern.
Yeah.
And then it pans and shows the ant playing the drums. But you get the sense of post-apocalypse, something has happened. Enough people got dusted to have the TV go off the air.
Yeah, no, it was funny, but I didn't find it that funny because you're right. In the background, you just sort of heard silence and you heard the test pattern noise. And so that way it was more ominous than funny.
Yeah.
It was a great juxtaposition of this ridiculous image of a giant ant playing drums versus clearly something horrible has gone wrong outside of that, yeah, which we know because we've seen Avengers. But I can't think of anything I would change about it. So
yeah,
they balanced all the characters pretty well. They introduced new characters who were fun. I like Ghost is interesting. I hope we see her again. Yeah. So let's, I guess let's do ratings out of five.
Ratings. Connor, what's your rating?
I'm going to give it a 4.
Yeah.
4 out of 5.
I think I got to give it a 4.5. And the 0.5 is for the Morrissey joke. I'm sorry. You do an explicit Morrissey joke in the middle of your movie, and I am your biggest fan.
Did you ever think you'd live to see a time when a major superhero movie would rely so heavily on Morrissey?
No, I'm shocked.
Do you think he ever thought he'd live to see that?
I'm shocked. I know I can tell you who doesn't care. He doesn't care. I'm shocked that it got through. I'm just shocked that I'm shocked that they had the idea to put it in, that it got through, that it stayed in, and that it, like, I just can't. And then it continued to be a recurring gag, whether you realized it or not. Like, yeah. I'm still blown away. So they get all the respect in the world, Paul Rudd and Peyton Reed and the rest of the team. I give you guys credit.
So there you go. Ant-Man and the Wasp in theaters now. If you go to iFanboy.com, you can go find the post for this show. Tell us what you thought of it. And I guess we'll be looking forward to more Ant-Man in the future as the end credits asked the question, will they be back?
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know. Stay tuned. So this is the end. I say with a large sigh of relief, this is the end of Marvel's 2018 movie slate. And then the next movie will be Captain Marvel in March next year.
And then followed by Avengers. Does it have a title yet?
That's no title yet. Okay. This is no title. The untitled Avengers movie.
Avengers, They're All Dead. Comes out in May.
And then where we go from there, we'll see. Although Spider-Man, there's a title for the Spider-Man movie.
That's right.
Tom Holland leaked it. It was Spider-Man Far From Home.
Well, yeah, he's dead.
Yeah, he's dead. So it's just
that's
be a
pretty
very
far.
Solid movie. So,
in terms of upcoming iFanboy special editions, this is the last major one for a while. We have a couple of animated films coming up. Death Superman is in August. And then I'm trying to find where here's my little calendar. I'm going to go out on a limb and say we're not going to review Venom.
Why?
I don't think anyone wants to see it in iFanboy HQ.
I think it's going to surprise you, my friend. Venom is the next one in October.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. I think
yeah.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say I don't think anyone wants to go.
Wow. But are you going to do Aquaman?
Yes, obviously.
All right, fair enough.
I'll discuss with Josh, but I don't think anyone wants to see Venom. But that's TBD.
I got to tell you, I watching that trailer, I bounced between, oh, like that is a pinball game of a trailer, that's for sure.
That's for sure, yes.
Yeah. Tom Hardy.
Until the next show, thanks for joining me, Ron. I'm Connor.
I'm Ron.